somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 32, Expert Opinion, Policing Opinion in the French Revolution, with Dr. Charles Walton. Last episode, we left off when the French philosophes had survived the concerted attacks of counter-Enlightenment factions and started to insert themselves into the cultural and political institutions of old regime France, institutions they had so long fought a game of cat and mouse with. Consequently, censorship loosened, and the public sphere gave rise to ever more daring ideas, not to mention gossip and rumors that gnawed away at the respect and awe previously enjoyed by throne and altar. In today's episode, we'll explore what happened to freedom of speech when the old regime collapsed and was replaced by the ideas of liberty, equality, and fraternity of the French Revolution. To guide us through this monumental episode of history, we have none other than Dr. Charles Walton, who's a member and former director of the 18th Century Center at the University of Warwick in the United Kingdom. Dr. Walton has taught at both Yale and Sciences Po in Paris, and is the author of the prize-winning book, Policing Public Opinion in the French Revolution, The Culture of Calumny and the Problem of Free Speech, which has been an incredibly important source for several episodes of this podcast. Charles, thank you so much for taking the time to do this interview.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
When I first started the research for this podcast, your book was one of the first I started reading, and I keep returning to it still because it describes so many striking developments that are found to be deeply relevant to understanding the conflict between free speech and authority, both in contemporary times, but really throughout the ages. And you also changed some perceptions about free speech in the French Revolution. But what got you started on writing the book and interested in this subject?
Yeah, well, thank you again for having me on the show. It's great to be able to talk about these ideas in a context where they can the nuances and complexities of freedom of speech can be analyzed. And I started this project more by happenstance. My original PhD project was to look at commercial politics during the French Revolution, and I went into the archives and was bumbling through the archives of the Terror, and I came across a letter written by Thomas Paine, addressed to Georges Danton, and Danton was head of the Committee of Public Safety at the time, in June of 1793. The Terror was just getting underway. And in this letter, Thomas Paine urges Danton to punish calumniators. And this gave me pause, because as an American, I knew Thomas Paine from the context of the American Revolution and knew that he was the author of the Rights of Man. I did not know, I should have probably by that time, but I did not know he was a deputy in the French National Convention at the time of the Terror. And I thought, this call to punish calumniators, people who attack leaders and institutions of the revolution, is bizarre coming from the author of the Rights of Man. So I started to realize that maybe free speech did not mean to them what it means to us today, and there was something to explore.
Especially since Tom Paine had to flee to France because he was convicted under some very strict sedition and treason laws in the UK as a response to the French Revolution. He might have been executed if he had stayed in England.
Indeed, it was his Rights of Man that got him convicted in absentia for sedition in Britain.
But this leads us to one of the central discoveries, I guess you could say, of your book, which is stressing the culture of honor and this dread of libel and calumny that was an enduring legacy of old regime France and which really hampered the efforts of the revolutionaries to settle differences peacefully through speech and writing. But what did calumny mean at the time, and why were even the most progressive Enlightenment philosophers adamant that it must be punished, and often severely?
Yes. So calumny, or a type of injurious speech, had several different meanings. In common usage at the time, it often shaded off into insults. You know, it was a kind of a blanket term for any kind of injurious speech. That was the common usage, but a more technical usage that you will find in philosophical tracts is that it is the false imputation of a crime or a vice to an individual, one that, you know, a crime or a vice that that person did not commit or does not have. And that's the definition you will find in Diderot and D'Alembert's Encyclopédie, the encyclopedia from the mid-18th century. But when the discussion of the freedom of the press began to get underway in the late 18th century, within 10 to 20 years before the revolution, calumny then started to, the meaning of it started to shift a bit. What matters is not truth as much as intentions and intentionality, which I think helps us understand the terror a bit more when, you know, revolutionary tribunals would be trying, and inquisitors would be trying to figure out what people's intentions really were. Where was your heart of hearts when the Bastille fell?
Now, according to some historians, including Robert Danton, who has done an incredible amount of research, especially into old regime France and free speech and censorship, there were actually good reasons to fear calumnies and libels. And he suggests that the institutions of old regime France were sort of sapped of their special aura and authority by the spread of malicious rumors and gossip in pamphlets, illicit books, and so on. So according to this interpretation, that speech actually contributed to the fall of the old regime. Do you share that conviction?
I would nuance it. And in fact, Robert Darton himself has a hard and soft version of that interpretation that you summed up there. And I agree with the softer interpretation. So the softer interpretation would go something like this, that the production or the proliferation of libels in the late old regime, especially libels about the court, pornographic libels and political libels, created narrative frames in people's minds. It told them in so many different ways the same story, that the regime, that the monarchy had degenerated into despotism. That was the overriding trope in all of those libels. And so that wasn't the cause of the revolution. But when crisis hit for other reasons, namely financial, that's the overriding cause of the French Revolution, the state was bankrupt, then the situation became very politically and economically complex. But people had this narrative in the back of their minds to help structure a confusing situation. And that narrative was very simple. It was that the monarchy had degenerated into despotism.
So even in the software version, these tropes helped really topple the old regime. We can perhaps also begin to understand why the revolutionaries and the different factions were so afraid of new tropes aimed at their sort of precarious new authority.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. One of the discoveries was that there was a large consensus among contemporaries of all political stripes that injurious speech did exist and that it should be punished. And I discovered that by analyzing the cahiers de doléances. These were documents drafted by thousands of parishes and circumscriptions around France on the eve of the French Revolution, in which they sent the king their complaints and their desires for reform. And many of them, as historians had noted, had called for freedom of the press. But what I found is they had already been prompted to answer that question, because the minister who invited them to write the Cahier de Doléances asked them that very question: what are your thoughts on freedom of the press? So it's not surprising then that they address the issue. But what historians hadn't noticed was just how many Cahier called for limits on the press. So freedom of the press, yes, but anything that goes against honor, the honor of individuals, religion, or good morals, or, and sometimes the monarchy, could be punished. And so that, so all they were asking for in 1789 was the abolition of pre-publication censorship, or what in the United States is referred to as prior restraint.
And there's some interesting differences between the different estates. You analyze how the different estates looked at press freedom. So the clergy would have one set of concerns, nobles another, and so on. Could you delve into that?
Well, first of all, I found it surprising that nearly a third of the clergy called for freedom of the press. But they were concerned about religion and the monarchy. The nobles were most concerned with individual honor, right? And then the third estate, so the cahiers were drafted by order, and the three orders were the clergy, nobles, and commoners, or the third estate. And the third estate was most concerned about mœurs. But when I say most for each of these categories, or each of these orders, all of the orders were concerned about all of those issues. It was just a question of emphasis. I counted which limitations each order put on, and the nobles were slightly more concerned about honor, individual honor, than they were religion, et cetera. But the basic idea, these categories, these limits that they invoked in these cahiers, came straight out of old regime laws, stretching back to the 1720s. Even in demanding freedom of the press, when they thought about limits, they reached back into the old regime and revived the limits that were already there.
That, of course, brings us to what many would consider sort of the landmark achievement of the French Revolution, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, which is still part of French constitutional order, legally binding, if I'm not mistaken, and was adopted on 26 August 1789 after an initial draft from Lafayette, which looked to American presidents. And it includes protections of freedom of conscience and expression in Articles 10 and 11. But these provisions were highly contested and far from unequivocal in their protection. So it would be interesting to explore with you sort of what were the competing views that clashed, who won out, and what did the declaration, what did Article 11 actually mean for the legal protection of press freedom and free speech after the adoption of the French Declaration?
The matter was not resolved with the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen. It actually installed vagueness about limits. And it was up to legislators then to figure out where the limits were after the fact.
Yeah, it sort of accepts abuse established by law, right? Which really is a can of worms in itself.
Exactly. So each of those clauses, Article 10 and Article 11, on freedom of conscience and religion and of expression, were both qualified by saying, except for abuses that will be defined by the law. The problem, and that's kind of the central problem that I explore in the book, is that absence in the Declaration of Limits became a political problem. And as one journalist and leading revolutionary commented in quite concisely in, I believe it was 1791, he said, to punish calumny while upholding, or to uphold the freedom of the press while punishing calumny, is one of the hardest problems to resolve in politics. And he was right on that. And so the deputies then in the national assemblies over the next 4 to 5 years would struggle to implement limits or to pass legislation. But they would do it in the heat of the moment. They would do it when there was clearly a winning and losing side in the National Assembly, So it always looked arbitrary. It never looked like they were defining limits from a calm, neutral, objective stance.
All right, we'll certainly get into that in more detail. But just to try to say, what was the immediate impact of the French Declaration? Was it the French Declaration that basically abolished pre-publication censorship? And what about the other old regime laws, institutions, and practices that were aimed at censorship? Because there was a battery of institutions and laws that I also explored in the last episode, where your book was also very useful, by the way. So what effect did the Declaration have on the laws on the 27th of August, 1789?
Yes, so in the backdrop of, well, first of all, we have to put into perspective how many people really paid it. I'm not going to say that the Declaration of the Rights of Man wasn't important at the time. It was, but there were so many other things that were also going on: eruptions of violence, you know, concerns about food. But to the degree that people started to invoke the Declaration as a right, they assumed that there were limits against sedition, or what they quickly coined, even before the Declaration, les nations, like les majestés was updated for the Revolution. It became les nations, and that les nations could involve expression against the nation or patriotism or the National Assembly. So that was hovering in the background, even as they were passing the Declaration of the Rights of Man. So now, in terms of institutions in the early revolution that would police, because there was a consensus that authorities had the right to stop seditions, municipalities would arrest, bully, intimidate journalists. They would seize pamphlets that they thought were incendiary or seditious, and this was across France. So there was a municipal revolution, so there were new authorities put into place, and they immediately took on the authority of policing print. But they did it in a very ad hoc manner, and there were no laws for several years. There were no laws guiding them on that. There was just a presumption that les nations existed and sedition needed to be stopped. And on those grounds, they would bully journalists. Meanwhile, the National Assembly, very early on, that same month, I believe it was in late July or August of 1789, they formed a police committee, a kind of, FBI, a national police committee that would investigate, accept denunciations and investigate coordinated efforts to stymie or overturn the revolution. You could say this is the precursor to the Committee of General Surveillance of the Terror, but they were looking for patterns and orchestrated efforts to overturn the revolution. So policing institutions persisted, even in the early revolution, the so-called freedom phase or liberal phase of the revolution.
Which is a term that your book really challenges. But just to be clear, I mean, after the Declaration, you had these royal censors. Were they still active? Did they have any power? Or, I mean, pre-publication censorship, that was gone, basically.
That was gone. And essentially, it had been whittled down even from the year before, because in 1788, in the summer of 1788, August, actually, so precisely 1 year before the Declaration, when the Crown called for a meeting of the Estates General for the following year, they freed up the press. They said any tract that is addressing the issue of the upcoming Estates General doesn't have to go through censorship. And so the floodgates were opened. They did lumber along. They did try to look at some things, but the censorship office was very small. It had fewer than 200 censors. And if you have a whole nation churning out print for the upcoming Estates General, they were outpaced by the production of print. So they were basically pre-publication censorship basically came to an end. You could say in 1788, it formally came to an end in 1789. The parliaments kept trying to punish printers and authors for works that they found seditious.
Just to be clear, parliaments here are meaning a bit confusingly, at least for English speakers, they were sort of regional courts, right?
That's right. They were appellate courts. They stretched back to the 14th century, and they registered royal decrees and served as a kind of high court in the land. And they would be abolished with the revolution, but some of them tried to maintain their power in autumn of 1789 and a bit through the spring before they of 1790 before they were completely abolished. And they also went, especially in Toulouse, they were very active down there and arresting publishers and journalists and writers.
So we have this explosion of print, as you say, while everyone agrees there has to be limits on free speech, so post-publication punishments for certain types of speech, but we still have different factions that argue for different limits, and you identify sort of what you call a quasi-libertarian position. What were their views on where the limit should be drawn, and as opposed to their opponents?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the reason that it was fun to work on that section of the book, because what I generally in the book, what I try to show is that their conception of freedom of the press was different than ours today. But I did manage to find a few exceptional instances of revolutionaries articulating a libertarian stance, which is that print can never be seditious. It can never be a matter of lèse nation. And that even if print were maliciously false, if accusations, you know, put into print were maliciously false, even in that against authorities, even in that case, the authorities' power as authorities more than counterbalanced the effect of a libel. So this seemed to me a kind of view that was that, you know, again, I speak as an American, that Americans hold. I think Americans in the 1990s and 2000s, they held what I think is a libertarian view. And so I wanted to show, well, yeah, that did exist in the revolution, but it was ephemeral. It was only put forward by a few revolutionaries. It was put forward by Robespierre and Pétion.
Yes, that was very interesting.
And yes, so the very people who will be active in trying to eliminate their political enemies in the Terror were the ones who were articulating the most radical free speech position.
Yeah, the Jacobins.
Right. But they did it under certain circumstances, and that's what's important to see, is they took up that view when it looked like the Jacobin Club was about to have a huge split, and it did have a huge split. A lot of the moderates in the Jacobins went to the Fayon Club in 1791, and the remaining bit, or the left-wing bit of the Jacobin Club, felt that they were going to be outpowered and outmaneuvered. So when you're in a position of inferiority, you tend to move towards a more libertarian conception of free speech because it serves your interests. Of course, when you have power, it's a different story.
Yeah. There's an interesting parallel here to the Sedition Act in 1798, where you have these founders who have been pounding on about the importance of free speech when opposing the British, and then the John Adams presidency adopts this Sedition Act, which imprisons journalists for the slightest criticism of his person and administration.
Yes, yes. So the Sedition Act was not just, I mean, one way to look at it is it was a violation of the founding principles. But it's not so clear even in the American case, and you probably know much more about this than I do, but when I was doing research for the book, I spoke with some lawyers and professors who work on this issue, and they alerted me to the fact that when the Americans called for freedom of the press and freedom of expression, they had a Blackstonian conception of it that dates from the 1770s, which consists of no prior restraint, no pre-publication censorship. But they assumed that you could be censored or punished after the fact. And even Benjamin Franklin said when they, with the Bill of Rights, he said, well, you know, we've now inaugurated the principle of freedom of the press, but nobody has any clue as to what its extent is, what its nature is and extent are.
Yeah. I think Madison is a great exception to that, both when he's sort of presenting the draft of what will become the First Amendment and specifically when responding to the Sedition Act in his report of 1800, where he sets out a very strong case for the freedom of expression, even against post-publication punishments. But it certainly was unresolved at the time. But let's get back to France, because it's a very interesting parallel, but you could still argue that the free speech tradition or culture in America, even if it was not as robust as now, did not lead to the same extent of persecution that took place in France during the Revolution. So we have, as we've mentioned a few times now, seen the floodgates open, and then you have this war of words that breaks out in pamphlets and newspapers with very quickly with sort of wild accusations and counter accusations. And I guess no one better symbolizes the hype of propaganda that became a staple of the revolution, at least in some writings, than those of Jean-Paul Marat, who ran the newspaper Friend of the People. So why did things get out of hand so quickly, and why has Marat become so notorious?
Yeah, well, his just reading his newspaper, it's easy to see why he is notorious. He's, you know, he calls for hanging people, hanging enemies of the nation on the lantern, and he's always looking for corruption. And in fact, the beginning of his notoriety started in September of 1789 when he denounced a municipal authority of some corrupt, underhanded act. And he was summoned by municipal authorities to the Hôtel de Ville, to the, you know, the city hall, to explain himself. And he apologized. He meekly apologized. And but then he went back and became even more
incendiary.
Yeah, incendiary. And why did he go that direction? A couple of reasons, and there is research that has recently been done on this by a PhD student in London on the early Marat. Now, Marat was a doctor. He was a scientist. He had won some prizes from academies. He was even about to be appointed to the head of the Academy of Spain. So this is a guy, this isn't somebody who came from the dregs from the gutter. This is somebody who worked for the Comte d'Artois, the king's brother. So he was an elite. And even though he wasn't born an elite, he was well-educated in Geneva as a Calvinist. But what explains his radicalism in part was his exposure to John Wilkes in the 1770s in Britain. He lived in England throughout the 1770s and became very interested and wrote about these public affairs. Now, the John Wilkes was somewhat a prototype for what Marat would become, a kind of hot-headed firebrand populist. Marat learned a lot from him. So you might argue that the kind of contentious, bold, brazen kind of public opinion that John Wilkes manufactured, Marat took that on board and then decided to, you know, exploited it or put it to use in the context of the French Revolution, and it sold papers. You know, it made him more famous than he had been when he was just a scientist and a doctor. So you know, there probably.
He would have had a huge following on Twitter today.
Yeah, yeah. And I think maybe towards the end we might come back to the, you know, the comparisons of the French Revolution and today. But yeah, if all the limits break down on freedom of speech, you can quickly have a toxic, politically toxic situation that then nobody can control.
So we have people like Marat, you have others who try to respond in kind. So what does the National Assembly do when these paper bullets are being fired in all directions?
Yeah, well, not a lot. They do some. They accuse them of lèse-nation, this kind of blanket sweeping category of injurious or incendiary speech, and then they have to go catch them. And they did accuse Marat of lèse-nation, but they couldn't catch him. And the more they tried to a couple of times, and they failed. And then it was worse, because then it looked like the authorities were weak because they couldn't pull it off. So then they stopped doing it. There was a lot of cat and mouse going on in those early years of press freedom.
But it's really interesting, this concept of lèse-nation. So it seems like you have this issue of calumny, this category of calumny that evolved from being focused on protecting the honor of individuals and institutions that embodied the social hierarchy of the old regime, to a protection of more collective egalitarian concepts and institutions like the people, the revolution, the state, and so on. Is that a correct interpretation? And what does that entail for free speech immediately after the revolution?
Yeah, so that's the more sociological side of my study. Cultures of honor generally involve the capacity to be able to avenge slights on one's honor. I think that's fairly universal in various honor-based societies. And that was certainly true in the Ancien Régime. So if you couldn't protect your honor, there was a real risk that you would not have access to opportunities in society. Right? What happens with the advent of civil equality is you have a democratization of honor. But with the democratization of honor, you have a democratization of vengeance. That means a desire to want to avenge yourself of calumny, calumnious attacks. And the best way to do that is to say, when somebody calumniated me, it wasn't just me that was calumniated, it was the nation. It was something bigger. So what you find throughout the revolution is people who are being calumniated saying, oh, if it were just me, if it was just a question of me, I wouldn't bother because I have enough, you know, dignity not to get into the gutter. But in attacking me, you've attacked the nation. Now what you've done, in a context where there isn't really civil law, you know, slandering some, they don't have slander laws yet for among individuals. So in this context where there's just this big category, lèse-nation, that's the only thing you have to go on. What you'll do is say that attack on me was really an attack on the nation, therefore it's lèse-nation. So there's this tendency in the absence of slander laws and regulations to inflate calumnious attacks into attacks on the nation. So it polarizes. It creates a very toxic and polarizing kind of political climate.
Even before the terror in 93, there are some developments that really serve to radicalize events. So we have this massacre at the Champ de Mars on 17th July 1791, where scores of protesters are shot by National Guardsmen. And you call this the Petite Terreur, or the Small Terror. And then you have the collapse of the monarchy in 1792, where you have breakouts of physical violence and a flurry of laws. So what happens after these developments? What are the consequences for free speech and censorship?
Yeah, so the 17, they're very different. So the massacre on the Champ de Mars during celebration of the anniversary of the Bastille being stormed, that happened on the heels of the attempted flight of the king. The king in June of 1791 tried to escape France. He got nearly across the border, but was identified, captured and arrested and brought back to Paris. But the deputies had been working on a constitution for 2 years, and they were almost done with it. It was a constitutional monarchy, but the monarch had just fled and was about to come back with counter-revolutionary troops to put the whole thing down. So that's when the Jacobins started to break between constitutional monarchists and Republicans. And skirmishes, there was a petition going around on the Champ de Mars to declare a republic and get rid of the king. And it was in this context that there was a skirmish and people ended up being killed, shot by National Guardsmen. So then the National Assembly and local authorities crack down on the kind of Republican radical left press. And they arrest some journalists. They arrest Camille Desmoulins. I think he spends time in prison, and there were others as well. But what it did, they were still 2 months out from finishing the Constitution. And what they did is they put some provisions in the Constitution that would kind of public safety type clauses that would allow the repression of speech that could kind of topple the order or threaten the political order. And what I found was, in looking at the Terror, when they condemned people for speech crimes in the Terror, and there were a lot who were condemned for speech crimes, they often invoked the 1791 clause. More often, I didn't look at all of them, but I did a sampling. And in my sampling, I found that this 1791 clause in this constitution that was supposed to be the kind of culmination of the liberal constitutional monarchy phase of the revolution, that clause was used more often than the law of suspects or the law of prairial. So you asked about 1792 as well. The fall of the monarchy is also the fall of the legislative assembly, because they have to now, they declare a republic and they have to have elections again within a month. So a lot of the policing institutions that were embedded in the legislative assembly, like that FBI type, you know, the Comité de Recherche and Comité de Rapport, they disappear. So all of those institutions now, all those policing institutions will have to be created from scratch on the national level. And then, but under conditions where, you know, the enemy is just a day or so outside of Paris, there's a war with all the power, you know, with all the surrounding powers of Europe, or almost all of them, soon to be all of them, and prison massacres, and, you know, it was mayhem. On top of that, you have municipal revolution. Another round of municipal revolutions where a whole new raft of often radicals came to power in the fall of 1792. And so that disrupted policing mechanisms. So there was a kind of fragmentation of policing mechanisms at precisely the time that war and civil war was ratcheting up. So you do have a lot of spontaneous types of policing going on, often by crowds. Or militias, or, you know, so it's there's not an orderly regulation of perceived speech crimes.
And then you mentioned the Terror, which is the most infamous and contested phase of the revolution, and where clashes over free speech and the responses thereto helped radicalize events on the ground. You've already alluded to the infamous Law of Suspects of September 17, 1793, which targeted those who, quote, by their conduct, relations, words, or writings show themselves to be the partisans of tyranny and federalism and the enemies of freedom. And then followed up by the law of 22nd Prairial, or June 10th, 1794, which imposed the death penalty on anyone found guilty of, quote, disparaging the National Convention and the Republic government, calumniating patriotism, spreading false news, misleading public opinion, corrupting the public conscience, and impairing the energy and purity of revolutionary and republican principles. Now, that sounds like a blanket check to basically persecute any and all opinion. And there are also these revolutionary tribunals that start arresting thousands of people for speech crimes. So what are the consequences of this very significant development?
Yes. Well, what was now called the National Convention had already started moving in this direction even before the Law of Suspects. The Law of Suspects of was in autumn of 1793. But the December before, December 1792, 5 months after the toppling of the monarchy, there were laws saying that anyone who opposes writes tracts that opposes laws that the National Convention passes is considered seditious and can be arrested, you know, can be arrested and punished. Then in March of the next year, just as they're starting to call for the revolution, they're just beginning to establish the revolutionary tribunals and the Committee of Public Safety. There are divisions within the national conventions. The Jacobins have now split. You have the Girondin faction and you have the Montagnard, the mountain faction, which was more radical. And they're at war with each other. And they pass a law that tries to please both sides. So the on the one hand, anybody, they reaffirm the law from December, which is anybody who goes up against the law or publicly denounces laws will be punished. And what they were referring to in this case was freedom of the grain trade, which was in the backdrop of a lot of speech crimes. The radical sans-culottes and the radical part of the Jacobin Club, the Montagnard, wanted regulated grain, so and regulated prices, and the Girondins were free marketers, very dogmatic free marketers. And so by saying we are going to punish, they use the word anarchie, anarchists, people who oppose the free trade grain law, they were attacking the radicals. But by they also said in March of 1793 that it is a crime to call for the restoration of the monarchy. And there were many Girondins who were kind of pro-constitutional monarchists, including Olympe de Gouges, who we might talk about in a few minutes. So basically, already before the law of suspects, you have a law that threatens to punish those who are angry about the free trade law and those who are upset about the king being executed and would like to go back to a constitutional monarchy. So that was already there before.
So basically you have these two factions who try to use to erect speech crimes as weapons against each other, which contributes to a general deterioration of free speech conditions.
But in terms of causes and consequences, I would say that these laws against speech crimes were not the cause of the terror. The terror had deeper, more underlying sources of friction. You know, what kind of political order do you want to have? And, you know, if you can't agree on that and everyone is attacking each other's honor over the kind of political order you should have, you get a very dangerous environment. So these restrictions, now they had never been opposed to restrictions except for the ultra, you know, quasi-libertarians who were few in number. They had never been against limits on speech. But now those limits were being articulated in the context of civil war, basically.
And in a very sort of partisan manner.
Yes. So it's very similar to, you know, what we're seeing today in Britain with, you have the difference, you know, the Remainers and the Brexiteers, well, calling each other, presenting each other as treasonous. They're starting to use these terms. And we're starting to see government not function because of it, you know. So there is a kind of an erosion, and even before our very eyes, we're seeing the political system starting to, you know, come unhinged. So we'll see where this goes.
But let's talk about both the number of victims and some of the individuals, because the number of people who were arrested for speech crimes and went before these revolutionary tribunals is just astounding. Yeah, almost 1,000 in Paris alone.
Yeah, that's right. A historian from the 1930s did a study, a quantitative study of the terror, and he found that about a third of the indictments were for speech crimes. And there were about 17,000 victims of the judicial terror. There were other forms of terror as well, like outright civil war and massacres. But in terms of the judicial terror, going before a court and having a judgment, about a third were for speech crimes.
And how many of these would have been executed?
Most of them. Because after the Law of Prairial, there really was only two... especially after Prairial, which is, I'm sorry, June 1794, the high point of the Terror. That's when you get masses of judgments and executions. So the peak times for the Terror were the fall of 1793, when civil war was still going on. The Federalists, who were looking for decentralized power and were aligned with the Girondins, and then the Centralists, the Jacobins, the sans-culottes, who wanted a more unified political system. There was a civil war between them in 1793, and that's the Terror really got going in that context. So there were lots of executions in the fall of 1793, and then they transfer a lot of the prisoners to Paris, and they consolidate the Revolutionary Tribunal to Paris. And now you have, you know, thousands of people being sent from all corners of France to Paris to be tried. And of course, the prison, there wasn't enough space in all the prisons for this. And then rumors started that there was going to be a prison breakout and kind of counter-revolutionary attempt to topple the government. And once those rumors spread, then the Revolutionary Tribunal really went to work and condemned a lot of people being held in prison.
So that would be something like 5,000 plus who were judicially executed for speech crimes?
Were judicially condemned. We don't know. Even that study, everyone cites that study from the 1930s by Donald Greer on the statistics. It's the most solid thing we have, but there are reasons. It's the most solid numbers we have, but there are reasons to question it, because his way of doing that research was to write to the archivists around France and ask them for the numbers.
So he didn't go into the archives himself.
Well, you could. I mean, and you would. It would be a lifelong project to do that. But
okay, but at least in the thousands, probably we can safely say that.
That's right.
But let's talk about specific victims. So women had already played a role, I guess, in the revolution. You have this women's march on Versailles. And then you have the famous Olympe de Gouges, who was this female playwright and author who drafted the Declaration of the Rights of Women, insisting that woman is born free and remains equal to man in right. And she also wrote that woman has the right to mount the scaffold, i.e. to be executed, so she should also have equally the right to mount the mostrum, i.e. to speak. And she was denied the latter, you could say, but granted the former. On November 3rd, 1793, she was guillotined for her ideas, not so much because of her feminism, as I understand it, but because she basically defended or opposed the idea of executing the king, right?
Yes. And she was very close with people at the court in 1789, and she was very close with the Girondin faction. So in her case, she was executed for several reasons that all kind of came together. She had written a tract recently before her arrest in which she imagined the country having a vote, a plebiscite, on what kind of political system they want. Do they want constitutional monarchy, a federalist system, or a more centralized system? And so she was at the height of the Civil War, when the Federalist revolts were going on in Lyon, Marseille, Bordeaux, Caen, where the Girondin leaning revolutionaries wanted to break away from Paris and centralization. She was publicizing like, hey, let's have a referendum on this. And so that did not endear her to the centralizers, who Jacobin Montagnard, who were in control and seeking to unify the country to fight against the rest of Europe. So the timing was bad. I mean, it was probably a good idea to have such a referendum, but not at that time. And she was allied. She was closely allied with the Girondins, and they were liquidating the Girondins. And on top of it, the sans-culottes movement was really powerful in the late summer, early fall of 1793, as the Terror was ratcheting up, and they were outright sexist. They did not want women in the political sphere or public sphere. And they shut down groups of women revolutionary activists. So it was a perfect storm. She was, you know, a politically outspoken writer. She was allied with the Girondins.
And she was an uppity woman who should have kept herself to her rightful place.
That's what many sans-culottes would have believed.
The end of the terror, I guess, you see fewer arrests and executions for speech crimes. But did it also result in a more liberal concept of free speech? What was the effect on those in authority? Did they say, well, you know, the lessons of what happened during the terror is that now we need to be libertarians on free speech. Everyone should be allowed to say what they want. Or was it that, you know, we still need to enforce limits?
The latter. The paradox of the post-terror period is that if you just look at the Constitution and the laws, it's more stringent on press freedom. And the Declaration of Rights that accompanies the Constitution of 1795 is very conservative. It de-enfranchises much of the male population, limits the right to vote to only the wealthiest. And it also contains in the Declaration, there's no call for free speech. Now, if you wade your way through the Constitution, the articles and provisions, there is one calling for freedom of speech, but it's curtailed by a subsequent article that puts limits on it for anything that threatens the order. And then laws were passed during the Directory period between 1795 and 1799 that were very, very strict. But so the rhetoric against freedom of the press and the laws and ordinances and the Declaration of 1795, all of that looks like things should be worse. But in practice, it wasn't as bad as during the terror. But a lot of that was by bullying. You know, you had to be licensed to run a newspaper. The policing organization started to become stronger, so they knew where the print shops were and they could kind of prevent them from a seditious press really, you know, getting traction. And they had a stamp duty too. The stamp duty made it expensive. And all newspapers had to go through the national postal system. So that meant then they had the state had their eyes on newspapers going through there. So the regulation, the laws are very strict, but there is less punishment. Now in 1799, they did exile about 100 journalists to the Isle of Oléron. They exiled them. They didn't execute them.
Yes, it's better to be exiled than executed. Okay, but let's try to take a step back from the events we have just covered and try and find some answers to how and why policing opinion became a matter of life and violent death. In a revolution that was formally committed to freedom of speech, at least a limited version of it. And I know this is a question that deeply divides historians, but still, let's give it a shot. So you demonstrate that the culture of honor played a crucial role, but does this suggest that France was not psychologically ready to robust free speech, and that Berg was right that incremental change would have been better than a flood of incendiary pamphlets that triggered everyone?
Yeah, but that just moves the problem back one level, and then you still have to figure, even if you're going to apply limits or implement freedom gradually, you still have to figure out where the limits are. So I'm afraid I only have paradoxes to offer. I think that some of the revolutionaries who commented on this, especially the quasi-libertarians, they realized that freedom of speech was that revolution was not the ideal circumstances to implement freedom of speech. But then you could also, but the paradox is, of course, you need a revolution to be able to to get. So that's where we are. I think what the takeaway is, two points. One, a libertarian world of free speech is not what people really, a majority really want. They say they want it, but when the stakes are high, when your honor and your financial interests or commercial interests are could be destroyed because of calumny, libel and slander, then you want protections. So the libertarian conception of free speech, the French Revolution kind of shows it may be a bit misguided. Even in fact, it's never really existed. Even today, there are limits on free speech, even in the U.S. But the other issue is the question of identity, and honor that's attached to your identity. You need a society needs a basic level of moral consensus, without which one person's act of justice looks like another person's act of injustice. And if you can't agree on those, the terms of what is right and what is wrong, even just a basic level of what is right and what is wrong, you're going to have civil strife. And in the context of civil strife, you will have freedom of speech anyway, because they can't control people. The different sides can't quite control it very well, and you'll have polarization.
There's some modern research which suggests that in democracies, free speech tends to limit conflict and extremism, whereas in countries that are authoritarian, if you suddenly impose free speech or lift censorship, then in certain instances, it might actually contribute to more conflict and extremism. And I guess 18th century France might be an example of the latter.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the studies that you might be have in mind. My question would be, okay, we can compare democratic societies and authoritarian societies, but what about democratic societies that are deeply polarized over fundamental issues of identity and political order, the way the system is supposed to work? What about those kinds of democratic societies? Is there a difference between what happens when you have free speech in a stable democracy versus an unstable democracy?
I have a bad feeling that we're about to find out in the coming years.
But just to return to that you need a minimum level of moral consensus for a society to function and for free speech to function.
You have to be able to extend tolerance to your most bitter opponent.
That's right. That's right. But what if there's no we there? What if there's only us and them? What if you don't see yourself as part of sharing the same kind of moral and political universe as your adversaries, and that they are othered? Now the whole thing breaks down.
So we're very close to the end, but I do want to ask you about the influence of the philosophe. I covered the writings of many of the most prominent philosophes in the past episode, and there's a tradition among some historians of ascribing the ideological origins of the terror to Rousseau, and I think it's well established that Robespierre was at least partially inspired by Rousseau, and so it might superficially at least be tempting to draw a direct line from Rousseau's insistence on compliance with the general will on pain of death and the mass execution of counter-revolutionary and royalists during the terror. I sense that you have a more nuanced view of Rousseau's legacy.
Yeah. I think Rousseau's, historians have gone back and forth as to his influence on revolutionaries, sometimes saying that the revolutionaries of 1789 really hadn't read him or digested him. They didn't understand the complexities of the general will, nor did Rousseau. Rousseau often said he had to rewrite that book because it had problems in it, and he never got around to it. So there is that view. And then there is the other view that was very strong especially between the 50s and the 80s, early 90s, that Rousseau did influence revolutionaries, and that he is illiberal because he doesn't tolerate, he wants the general will, he wants unity. Whereas liberals believe in pluralism. What I try to do in this book is to show, you know, that problem that, you know, we agree to disagree. I think what Rousseau saw was that we agree bit of that statement needs to be there before you can disagree, before you can, you know, and you need a we. So I think it might be misguided to blame the terror and the crackdown on free speech.
The final question. So even in the 21st century, French governments have often resorted to policing opinion when faced by crises or ideas that were thought inimical to Republican values. So this includes very tough laws against glorification of terrorism. In fact, a few days after everyone had said, "Je suis Charlie," after the attack on Charlie Hebdo, the French government started arresting people for glorification of terrorism through speech. You can also be punished for advocating boycott of Israel, for condoning war crimes. You have the ban on the face veil, which affects religious speech. And most recently, you have new laws against fake news and online hate speech. So are these restrictions on freedom of conscience and expression a legacy of the complicated and perhaps unresolved relationship between French Enlightenment concepts of mores on one side and freedom on the other?
Yeah, I think they capture France's particular trajectory in throughout the modern period, from the Enlightenment to the present. You know, France differs. So, you know, just to draw a contrast with the United States, we think that morality is a question as a private and personal matter, and that you can have different faiths and arrive at a moral code on your own. In fact, you don't even need a religious faith. You can be, but the individual's the arbiter of their own morality. France had a more conflictual relationship with religion all through the 18th century. During the Enlightenment, you know, the Enlightenment really broke ground in the 1750s with the public. The Enlightenment went public in the 1750s when there were sharp divisions between two different Christian, you know, factions, if you will, the Jansenists and the Jesuits. So there's always been religion has always been tied up with the question of morality. When some of the church or the powerful sectors of the church in the French Revolution turned against the French Revolution and became counter-revolutionaries, at that point, the revolutionaries said, "Hey, wait a second. You know what? We used to think," and they say this quite explicitly in 1792, "we used to think that, you know, Christian and Muslim and Jewish morality, that would be fine. Everybody has their own religion and that morality will suffice. But because of the Catholic Church's war against the revolution, they said, you know what, we need to create a new morality that is secular based. But they treated it as if it was almost a substitute for religious morality. It became a religious morality in its own right. It's what the French call laïcité. And then that gets started in the French Revolution, and it'll be revived in the Dreyfus Affair, in the Third Republic, when Republicans in the 20th century say, come to the conclusion that many revolutionaries had come to, which is we need a basis of unity and morality. We need a moral code, if you will, or a moral way of looking at our political society that isn't attached to any particular religious group. And so that's why I think France has always wanted to regulate speech in order to safeguard that kind of Republican secular morality. The problem is, in practice, it often serves to stifle minorities.
Thank you very much, Charles. That was excellent. This has really been enlightening. And thank you very much also for your book, which has been a huge inspiration.
Great. Well, thank you.